Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you two special features focusing on the week of prayer for promoting Christian unity. But first, I'll be reporting on some of the events currently taking place here in the Vatican, beginning by stepping back in time to Sunday's Angelus with Pope Benedict. Thanks so much for joining me once again. Well, yes, they kept their promise on Sunday. They came from across Italy, 200,000 faithful gathering in St. Peter's Square. Arriving early, they gazed upwards in anticipation towards the Holy Father's study window, which overlooks the square. If you'd been around that day and had not read your Italian daily, you might just have wondered why there were so many of them there. Charles Collins fills in the picture for us.
200,000 people converged on St. Peter's Square Sunday morning to greet Pope Benedict as he made his Sunday Angelus. They were reacting to the events last week, which caused the Vatican to cancel a scheduled appearance of Pope Benedict at Rome's La Sapienza University. A small minority of professors and groups of anticlerical students threatened protests if he arrived.
Conosco bene questo ateneo, lo stimo e sono affezionato agli studenti che lo frequentano.
Speaking to the crowds on Sunday, Pope Benedict had said that he had willingly accepted the invitation, knowing the university well. He said he respects La Sapienza and is fond of the students, and meets with them many times during special events at the Vatican. But he said an atmosphere was created which made his presence unadvisable, and that he had canceled the visit unwillingly. Since that decision was made, students, educators, politicians, and others from across Italy have been showing their solidarity with the Pope. Several carried signs last week saying that if the Pope cannot go to La Sapienza, La Sapienza will go to the Pope. On Sunday, they kept their promise. The prefect of the Congregation for Divine Worship, Cardinal Francis Arinzi, was also there, and he said last week's events show a lack of understanding of the Catholic Church's views on education.
The Catholic Church is for research, for the meeting between faith and reason. The earliest universities were begun by the Church, and also even the University Sapienza was begun by Pope Urban VIII. So the Church is all in favor of research and reason and faith to meet, definitely. And that is to the good of mankind and to the good of universities and free speech.
His sentiments were echoed by several other people in the square.
University students are interested in listening to what the Pope has to say. And this interest, of course, as a Christian or just as a secular individual, is to see what it is that the Pope is trying to offer a university student like myself.
And what happened in the university is that he was negated his right to speak as a head of the church and also as a head of a state. So it's a harm that we experience in this society, because when one is negated the right to speak.
The Holy Father speaks the truth. He walks with the church, and he's the vicar of Christ, and this is a great testament of faith for the people of God to support the Holy Father.
Pope Benedict thanked the crowd many times for their show of solidarity and blessed them from his apartment window. I'm Charles Collins.
Assicurando il mio affetto e la mia preghiera. Grazie.
And while my thanks go there to Charles Collins for this report, Do stay tuned as he updates us on one of the many events on Benedict XVI's Monday schedule. In the morning, in fact, the Pope received in audience the participants at the plenary assembly of the Congregation for Catholic Education.
Pope Benedict received the participants at the beginning of their meetings, during which they will discuss issues relating to the formation of priests and religious and the current state of Catholic higher education. A particular concern to the congregation is the current state of the ecclesiastical institutions of higher learning. Pope Benedict told the participants it would be very useful to consider the possibility of reforming the apostolic constitution governing ecclesiastical faculties.
Altrettanto utile è valutare l'opportunità di una riforma.
The Holy Father said such an evaluation is needed in light of the Holy See's participation in the Bologna process of integrating higher learning in Europe. The Holy See joined the Bologna process in 2003. The 1979 Apostolic Constitution, Sapientia Christiana, serves as the basis for the formulation of criteria for evaluating the quality of the pontifical faculties and institutions of higher learning. Pope Benedict said the ecclesiastical disciplines, above all theology, are faced with new questions.
Le discipline ecclesiastiche, soprattutto la teologia.
The Pope said the world is tempted on one hand by rationalism, which follows a rationality of false freedom, loosed from all religious reference, and on the other by fundamentalisms that violently raise the religious points of reference to the level of absolutes, thus detaching them from reason. Pope Benedict encouraged the participants in the reflections and imparted his apostolic blessing. The plenary assembly of the Congregation for Catholic Education concludes on Wednesday, January 23rd.
Thanks again there to Charles Collins. And moving on in the broadcast, well, it's lambing time in the Vatican once again. In fact, to coincide with the feast of St. Agnes, Pope Benedict blessed two lambs. The lamb's wool, as you probably know, will be used to weave the new pallia this year.
According to tradition, St. Agnes was a member of the Roman nobility, born about the year 291 and raised in a Christian family. On January 21st, AD 304, during the reign of the Emperor Diocletian, Agnes suffered martyrdom. She was 12 years old. The prefect, Sempronius, wished Agnes to marry his son, and on Agnes' refusal, he condemned her to death. As Roman law did not permit the execution of virgins, Sempronius had a naked Agnes dragged through the streets to a brothel. As she prayed, her hair grew and covered her body. It was also said that all of the men who attempted to rape her were immediately struck blind. When led out to die, she was tied to a stake, but the bundle of wood would not burn, whereupon the officer in charge of the soldiers drew his sword and struck off her head, or in some other texts, stabbed her in the throat. She was buried in the catacomb given her name. Each year on the feast of St. Agnes, two lambs, garlanded and crowned with roses, are brought into the Basilica of St. Agnes outside the walls, in baskets, placed on the altar above St. Agnes' tomb, and blessed at Mass. The lambs are then taken to the Basilica of St. Cecilia in Trastevere, where the Benedictine nuns attached to the basilica weave their wool into pallia. A white woolen band embroidered with six black crosses, which is worn over the shoulders and has two hanging pieces front and back. The pallium is worn by the Pope and by Metropolitan Archbishops. The pallium symbolizes authority and expresses the special bond between the bishops and the Roman Pontiff. I'm Chris Altier.
And my thanks there to Chris Altieri. Meanwhile, in the Vatican this morning, a press conference took place focusing on this current year dedicated in a special way to St. Paul. Irene Lagan went along to the Vatican press office this morning and found out more. Let's listen.
The week of prayer for Christian unity will close this coming Friday. To close out the week, Pope Benedict XVI will celebrate Solemn Vespers at the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. The celebration of Solemn Vespers on the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul annually brings together Orthodox, Protestant, and Anglican leaders to pray more intently for unity among Christians. Vespers this year will anticipate the year dedicated to St. Paul, invoked by Pope Benedict at the end of 2007. At a press conference Monday, Vatican officials spoke in anticipation of the year ahead, which will begin on June 28th with first Vespers of the Solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul, and will extend through June 29th, 2009. Archpriest of the Basilica of St. Paul Outside the Walls, Cardinal Andrea Cordero Lanza di Montezemolo, said that among the central themes of the Year of St. Paul will be prayer and work for the unity of all Christians and a united church, the true mystical body of Christ. In proclaiming a year dedicated to St. Paul, the Cardinal explained that Pope Benedict XVI wanted Catholics to mark the bimillennial anniversary of St. Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, who carries the good news to all people in a particular way, and who dedicated himself totally to unity and concordance among all Christians. The Cardinal said the Holy Father wishes Catholics and Christians to turn to St. Paul for help in carrying to completion the humble and sincere quest for full unity among all the members of the mystical body of Christ. Among the special events of this year will be ordinary and extraordinary liturgical celebrations to accommodate both Catholics and non-Catholic Christians. The baptistry chapel will be transformed into an ecumenical chapel, highlighting the one baptism shared among all Christians. A range of other pastoral, educational, cultural, religious, and interreligious programs are planned throughout the year, including special tours to Pauline sites throughout Rome. I'm Irene Lagan.
And Irene Lagan's report takes us to the end of the first part of this broadcast. As announced earlier, the second part will focus on this week of prayer for promoting Christian unity, a special week by the theme this year of praying without ceasing. It's a theme which points to a special anniversary, a century since Paul Watson of the Society of the Atonement at Graymore in the United States observed that first church unity octave, something I explained in detail in a previous broadcast dated January 18th. You can find it on our website at www.vaticanradio.org. But getting back to this broadcast, in a few moments I'll be taking a look at some other aspects relating to ecumenism. That's with the same guest, Father James Pugliese, the Minister General of the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement and director of the Rome-based Ecumenical Centre Pro Unione. And it seems I asked an awkward question. In his words, a trick question. Just listen. Do you think that more has been done at a grassroots level rather than a theological level? Paving the way
that's
Christian unity.
Yeah, I would call that a trick question, and I usually try to avoid trick questions, but let's look at it this way, that it's kind of comparing two different realities. There has been tremendous progress, I think, made on both levels. The problem is that when we start making some determinations, some people are trying to call this the ecumenism of the people. That is, that the people are going their own direction and forgetting about the so-called official ecumenism or the ecumenism of the hierarchy. Both are necessary. We realize historically when we looked at the church, many things entered in as change because they weren't initiated from above, that they did initiate from the bottom. And they were eventually received as legitimate change within the church. But at the same time, if the gap grows too great between the body of the church and the head, the so-called head of the church, with the hierarchical dimension of the church, we forget really what the teaching of the Second Vatican Council is all about. Because remember, the decree on the church, the constitution on the church, changed its view of looking at the church as being defined as first and foremost by the hierarchy to being defined first and foremost as the people of God. And then inserting in the people of God the hierarchy at the service of the people of God. And I think this is a correct theological balance that sometimes we feel the pinches here because the faithful who are the people of God want to move a little bit more rapidly and maybe in a different direction. And we have the teaching of the church in the Second Vatican Council and even before with someone like Cardinal Newman about the sensus fidelium, that is the sense of faith that resides in the faithful. And I think we really need to consider that even more important because there has to be a dialogue between these two levels. So I would say that there has been tremendous progress on both levels. One, that the people of God have received what went on at the Second Vatican Council and the ecumenical progress since then. And then secondly, on the level of the hierarchy and the official dialogues, great progress has been made in terms of common understanding of our faith.
Do you think people are interested in ecumenism in general?
They are and they aren't.
I mean, the average churchgoer.
Yeah, well, it depends what country we're looking at, I think. I think that's the way I would say it, because my confreres say, what are you doing ecumenism in a country that's 93% or 95% Catholic? Well, it means that we, as Catholics in this country, are most authentically Catholic. And we know that when we look at our church, that in many cases we're not authentically Catholic. We're not conforming to really what the gospel wants of us, what the church wants of us in terms of our own commitment and witness in the world. So from that point of view, I think ecumenism becomes important because it gives some people the right to ask questions about their faith. Faith is something that has to be interrogated. It has to be pushed. It has to be understood because it is a part of the mystery of what God gives us and calls us to. And obviously no mystery can we fully grasp because then it no longer is a mystery. But it calls us further and further into that. So in a place where, or a country where the majority of people are Catholics, ecumenism is very important because usually it means they can talk with other brothers and sisters who are Christians about their faith. Because in an overly Catholic church, one would say, well, it's given for granted. And so it's very easy to be Catholic, but it's not really, because there's no intelligence of the faith, there's no understanding of the faith, and therefore there's no incarnation of the faith. So in that context, it's very important for one reason. In other contexts where the church is a minority, it's very important because sometimes for the survival of the church, the only way is to do this together as Christians. And of course, I think that it's important for the gospel itself, because if we cannot witness to the gospel together, if we cannot act together in the world as Christians, well, then what is the meaning of this gospel? Why is Jesus so unique? And that was the whole question of a document that came out some years ago that caused a lot of ink to be spilt on pages, Dominus Jesus, the uniqueness of Jesus as our Savior.
If Father Paul Watson were to appear suddenly today, do you think he'd be disappointed, or do you think he'd be happy about what's happened since in this century?
I think he would be very excited about some of the things that have happened. And that's a very good question, actually. I've thought about that several times. Because he, being an Anglican in the very beginning, wanting to see communion between the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church, and because of certain decisions that were made of the Episcopal Church in the United States at the turn of the century, that is the 1800s to the 1900s, said we were not going in the direction that would lead us to Christian unity. We have a similar situation today in the Anglican communion today, where there are many questions that are being raised by Anglicans throughout the world. And I think that he would be happy that we've gone this far, and I think he would be saddened by the fact that within the church that he loves so much, the Anglican church, he still sees this tension that resides, that has not been able to be resolved within the Anglican church itself. And I know that many sincere Anglicans, from left or right, however you want to describe their allegiance, are very saddened by this. And as Catholic ecumenists, we don't encourage them to continue to split apart. No, we encourage them to continue to talk to one another, because nothing is so important that what should divide them, because we don't want to see another Reformation. We don't want to see another drastic tearing apart of the church itself, especially within the same confession. So obviously, we promote them staying together. We promote them speaking to one another to find a way forward, because they won't find a way forward. But it is the prayer that will open them up to finally saying the Spirit is leading them forward. That's what I think is important about prayer, because it opens us to a force that goes beyond us, because real prayer is not just asking us something of God, it's listening first and foremost. And then secondly, it's really realizing what God has already done to answer what that petition is. But all our prayers really needs to turn to recognizing who God is in our life, so that we can really become the authentic creatures that he wants us to be in his plan of salvation.
Is music part of that prayer?
Oh, so much so. I think, you know, singing brings the soul alive. It's a sense of unity and communion and harmony, because when you realize that you have so many individual people who are created that way, that can produce a sound that is so harmonious. And even when there's dissonance, it brings us to an understanding of the reality of our life together. But just the dynamics of singing is very important, because when you sing, you have to take in lots of oxygen. Oxygen brings life to the body, and therefore it makes us alive. And I think that's the really important part. And you know, some of the first heresies were propagated because of singing. Arius was a hymn writer, and he propagated his heresy by writing hymns, maybe like taking the song, My people row the boat ashore and saying, you know, Jesus is not really God, he's only man. And so, you know, when you sing something, things keep rolling around in your head. And so people began to believe these things. And the church combated it by writing new hymns.
And many of the hymns were written by Protestant.
Yes, we have a rich heritage of the Wesleyans, for example, whose anniversary we celebrated just recently, Charles Wesley. Yes, many of those hymns. We just finished the Christmas season. All the Christmas hymns that we traditionally sung, most of them have been written by Protestants. So we have a rich heritage. And many of the texts go back to where? The Bible. They go back to biblical texts. And they express in many ways the completeness of the theology that we can't do always in the prayers that we say. Because usually texts, good texts anyway, hymn texts are poetic. And sometimes they leave those verbs out and they allow us to make the connection both in our minds and then eventually in our lives.
Is there anything you want to add?
Well, just that we encourage your hearers to join with all of us in this anniversary of 100 years and of 40 years of praying for the unity of the church. But most of all, to realize that prayer in daily life, because it's not just a week of prayer. It is a daily event. Every celebration of the Eucharist that we do is a prayer for unity, because the Eucharist means unity. And we need to pray that God will open our hearts and prepare us to receive that gift. We're not creating the unity. We have to receive that gift from God when we have been prepared sufficiently for it.
And act like Christians.
Especially. That's the heart of it. It doesn't mean anything to call oneself Christian, but to be Christian in an authentic way means to live that gospel authentically.
Thanks there to Father James Pugliese, Minister General of the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement and Director of the Rome-based Ecumenical Centre, Centro Pro Unione, who, as you've just heard, mentioned the Wesley brothers. That's why in a moment I've chosen to end the broadcast by offering you a musical moment relating precisely to them. That's with our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
If I had to single out the family who made the greatest contribution to writing hymns, I think it would have to be the Wesleys. You've probably heard of John Wesley. He founded the Evangelical Revival Movement in 18th century England and America, which grew into the Methodist Church. But it was his less famous brother, Charles, who wrote most of the hymns. Over 6,500 of them. I think that has to be a record. Wesleyan hymns were designed for evangelization. They taught Christian doctrine, they stirred up religious fervor, and they attracted new converts. Imagine hearing them sung with great gusto in large open-air gatherings. No wonder people came flocking. A good number of Charles Wesley's hymns are still sung today. One of the best known is probably this Christmas carol. Another is a well-known hymn for the Ascension. These are not the tunes the Wesleys themselves would have known. Many of the tunes were written much later. The tune for Hark the Herald was written by Mendelssohn, and it was the brainwave of a 19th century editor to match the tune to the words, giving us one of the best loved of all Christmas carols. Hail the Day That Sees Him Rise uses a Welsh tune, again written during the 19th century. But the hymn I want to focus on today is normally sung to a tune written by Charles Wesley's grandson, Samuel Sebastian Wesley. Hymn writing certainly ran in the family. Wesley's son, Samuel, was quite a distinguished composer in his own right, but his son, Samuel Sebastian, is the one better remembered nowadays. The name Sebastian was given him in honour of Johann Sebastian Bach, head of another great musical family. Samuel Sebastian worked as organist in a number of Anglican cathedrals during the 19th century. While he was at Hereford Cathedral, he wrote one of his best-known works, the anthem Blessed be the God and Father. Hereford is the name of the tune that Samuel Sebastian Wesley wrote for his grandfather's hymn, O Thou Who Camest From Above. It's an excellent hymn to sing at a confirmation or an ordination, because it calls on the Holy Spirit to come down and kindle a flame of sacred love in our hearts. There are echoes of St. Paul's second letter to Timothy as we sing, Still let me guard the holy fire, and still stir up thy gift in me. The final goal of the Christian, though, is the union with God which awaits us at our death. We sing of the acts of faith and love which nourish us spiritually in this life, till death thy endless mercies seal and make my sacrifice complete.
Heartfelt thanks, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. That's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. I do hope you all enjoyed this programme. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.